Hi, this is Doug Lynn, and welcome to The Modern Enthusiast. I'm joined in the studio by Adam.
Hi.
And our special guest, Corey Fay, here.
Hello.
James is out on business and will not be joining us this week, so we've replaced him with Corey. Corey is an excellent local player here, very skilled, and we are pleased to have him on the cast today. If you would like to talk to us, you can find all of our show notes on mtgcast.com. You can also tweet us. Our name there is Modern Podcast on Twitter. And you can email us. You'll find the email link also in the show notes on mtgcast.com. Each week we talk about Modern. Last week we talked about cards that were upcoming. We talked about the recent big event in Madrid. And we have more to talk about as well this week. First off, Adam, you had a Star City event this weekend that you had wanted to talk about. So tell us about that.
So I was looking at the decks that had done well at the Star City. I think this one was in Richmond this past weekend. And there were some very interesting, things that I noticed, about the top 16. There's only one deck, in the top 16 that was playing Treasure Cruise. It was the one straight up blue-red Delver deck. It had four Treasure Cruises, but those are the only ones that appeared. There were lots and lots of dig through times, and a lot of that. Basically, every blue deck except the blue red Delver deck in the top eight had at least one copy of dig through time. So there's been, I think, a little bit of a shift from what people were playing before with the Treasure Cruises to the dig through times. And to be fair, a fair number of the decks that are playing the dig through time, are combo decks, like Scapeshift and Twin, but there is also a Rug Twin deck that is not too much about comboing and much more about tempoing out your opponent, that has Dig instead of the Treasure Cruises. So I think that's pretty telling about the two cards and what people are like. People are certainly now experimenting more with Dig Through Time than they were before. The thing I found most interesting about the deck that won, which was a Scapeshift deck, was that he only played three copies of Scapeshift, which I thought was pretty interesting. It's got Courser of Crucifix in the deck, which I think was a card we had talked about before.
I think it was, yeah.
In Scapeshift. So, I know Corey's been playing Scapeshift a lot in our local tournaments.
Corey, maybe you can tell us what you think about the idea of cutting a Scapeshift and adding two Coursers. Maybe not just a total swap like that, but do you ever find you have games where Scapeshift just clogs your hand?
Sometimes you do have multiple Scapeshift, but it allows you to run out the first one and not be afraid of counterspells. And in my list, I go the four Izzet Charms, so it's nice to have whatever extra cards because you can always just discard them. The two Coursers I noticed, they are playing Izzy Electrolyze, which seems fine as a 3-drop. Because it still stops the aggressive. You can gain life and stop ground creatures. But at the same time, you're good against the mid-range decks because you can still get the card advantage while still pushing ahead.
Yeah, this particular list cut all of the Electrolyzes and is playing two Farseeks, a Pyroclasm, and two Coursers, which I've seen Farseek in lists before. It's usually the card you go to if you want to ramp a little more beyond Search for Tomorrow and Sakura Tribe Elder. The Pyroclasm is interesting. It's certainly a hedge against the blue-red Delver decks. And I find that a little bit interesting. I guess it's also good against like the Mana Dorks out of Pod. But I find that a little bit interesting because Pod was all over this top 16 just like it was all over the top 8 in Madrid. So I think the metagame has really sort of shifted back around, you know, the blue-red Delver deck. And it's still a fine deck choice, but there was only one blue-red Delver in the top 16 and even top 8. So I think that's very telling that the format is sort of, you know, shifting again.
You know, I think that's something we had talked about when these two cards had first seen a big spike. Yeah, especially with the Jeskai Ascendancy combo deck, was, are these strategies that people are going to be able to stop? or are they going to be like playing an Arcbound Ravager and a Skull Clamp, and that no matter how many Molder Slugs and Oxidizes you run, you're still going to get stomped by it. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that more and more people are tuning their decks to be able to contain these, and I think it is a good thing and a healthy sign for the format that we're only seeing one Treasure Cruise deck in the top 16.
Oh, yeah, I think...
And no Ascendancy combo also.
That's interesting, too, actually, in and of itself. I think this top 8 in the Madrid top 16, this top 16 in the Madrid top 16 show that the metagame is pretty healthy because you have a really high mix of different decks, and there are people doing a lot of different things. So, you know, you've got Pod and Scapeshift, and there's a Blue Area Control in the top 8, but there's also Affinity and Twin, and a guy playing a Scred Red deck, which it's too bad James isn't here, because he'd be very happy about that. It's basically a glorified burn deck, but it is an interesting strategy nonetheless. But the thing I kind of want to talk about with the Scapeshift deck is, do you think that not running the full amount of your combo cards is a good thing if you're cutting it for something else? So it's a little bit different with Scapeshift because Scapeshift is not a deck, at least pre-board, that is going to win with anything but casting Scapeshift 99% of the time. So having only three Scapeshifts, although you've got a lot of dig through times, a lot of ways of digging, like getting through your deck to find your cards, sometimes it's hard, or sometimes there's no replacement for just having as many combo targets as you can. So I don't know what you guys, what do you guys think about that?
I can't imagine that three is right. Like, having a fourth is just always better, because many times during the game, yeah, you can be more controlly, and you're just hoping to draw it later, but it seems better to just have as many chances as you can to draw it.
I agree. You know, I think that you know, it's cool to want to sit back and be the Cryptic Command deck and be all about your Snapcasters and sculpting the perfect hand, but there are games when your opponent taps out for a turn or has to do something, and it's great to be able to go for it. And I guess you have to ask yourself, do you want to be the Cryptic Command deck / Snapcaster Remand deck, or do you want to be the Scapeshift deck? Mm-hmm. I know that we had talked about before the show, a Rug Twin deck that had been in that top 8 that had only three copies of Splinter Twin, two Exarchs, and two Pestermites. Now, that is backed by Tarmogoyfs and Huntmaster of the Fells, so there you're saying, you know, you're going to be able to play two solid plans, and if you don't have the fourth Splinter Twin, that doesn't matter, but if you're playing a standard blue-red Twin deck, I've seen people shaving the fourth Splinter Twin, and let me tell you, Dig Through Time doesn't draw you 21 cards, it only shows you 7, and being able to hit that Twin when you need it really matters.
I can understand some of those, because they are 4 drops, like, and they do the same thing, you only usually need one to win the game. I can understand those getting clogged in your hand, but I think the trade-off for those decks has to be better when you are holding the other pieces, and you really need to combo, and you can't find them because you don't have, like, you only have 3 instead of 4.
Mm-hmm.
And that really changes your percentages for finding that card. Twin also is a little bit different in that sense than Scapeshift, because Twin is capable of winning without actually executing its combo. So at least might be an argument for not running the full number of Twins. Mm-hmm. But the Scapeshift one... Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical about just running 3 Scapeshifts. I wish Star City did a little bit more coverage of the decks, like did some deck techs, or at least had a couple articles about some of the stuff they did with the Modern Tournament, because I'd be very interested in hearing if there was a reason that there weren't 4 Scapeshifts. It could have just been he left one at home, or he couldn't get his hands on the fourth one, and it just happened to fall the way it did. Or if there was, you know, if there was a real decision tree and there was some real some stuff behind why he didn't want to run the fourth Scapeshift.
Yeah, and to the credit, you can Snapcast a Scapeshift, so it's it's not like running 3 Splinter Twins exactly.
Yeah, he had one Snapcaster also in his deck. Like, he had the 4 digs, 2 as it charms, a lot of a lot of ways of getting through your deck, especially with the coursers and then the main deck Pyroclasm. But definitely a little bit of an interesting take on Scapeshift. There was another Scapeshift deck in the top eight as well. This one was a lot more standard. I think it's extremely close to the list that James and Corey have been playing around with. It had a main deck Gigadraus, which seems pretty awesome against fighting the other blue decks that are trying to do that, are trying to counterspell you out, basically, and looks a lot more standard. No Courser of Crucifixes, basically.
Four Scapeshift.
For the full four.
The Gigadraus is in place of the fourth Cryptic, which they basically do the same thing where they can tap down their team, but it's also better against the control decks where you can just tap them out.
Now, Corey, I have seen you play Scapeshift locally and play to just a game where you're digging for the Gigadraus, and it is incredible when the Scapeshift deck can sit back and do that. And, you know, they find the Gigadraus, their opponent's got the cards in hand, and then you just tap down all their islands and then present the Scapeshift, and that's that, you know. There's not a whole lot of tuning that can go into building a hand that that can get away with that stuff.
Yes, Scapeshift just seems so good in that, Dig Through Time seems so good in that deck just because it lets you sculpt just basically the perfects. And I think that Scapeshift is probably, maybe not even so secretly, the best deck in the format right now because you can play the control deck against the decks where you want to do that, and you can play the combo deck against decks where you want to combo, and then in the sideboard, a lot of times you'll have some creatures or a Karanos or some other way of winning the game when that is a thing that you need to do. And against the decks like the Blue Red Revelation deck, they can't like tap out for their Haymakers because the threat of you just comboing them is there, but you can also control the game, and because they don't really pressure, you can take as much time basically as you want to set up the hand that that can't lose. And because your combo involves putting lands into play, you don't even have to cast Scapeshift eventually. You can just play Mountains and Lightning Bolt your opponent, or if you don't ramp at all, it's okay because you're just going to get to 7 or 8 lands and then cast Scapeshift and the game is going to end. So it's, I think it's a very, very good deck. There are also 3 pod decks.
So this is something I wanted to talk about too, is that Malira Pod has really seen a resurgence. You know, I'm using that as shorthand to also mean the decks that play Archangel but don't play any Malira. I suppose we're calling them Junk Pod or Abzan Pod, as that shell.
Angel Pod, I think Angel is what Pod. LSV called them.
They are often, and they're running more Voice of Resurgence. So here's one thing I noticed too, is looking over Delver decks, we were talking about how they evolved to beat each other. Mm-hmm. So they're doing things like running 3-4 Bolt main deck, but they're cutting the Pillar of Flame and the Magma Spray, and maybe they'll have one on the sideboard. Now, both of those cards are very good against a Pod deck, but when you play against Pod and they play their turn 1 Noble Hierarch, you kill it with Forkbolt, next turn they play Voice, you don't really have anything you can do at that point, and then they follow it up with, say, a Kitchen Sphinx, they sneak a Birthing Pod through, anything like that. Once they get into getting the Siege Rhino, that's when things get really, really messy.
Voice is just so good against the Delver decks because it will either trade or block with pretty much all their stuff in combat except for a flip Delver, and it makes so much of their game plan just bad, with not being really able to be, like, profitably cast spells, on your opponent's turn. All 3 of the pod decks in the top 16 in Richmond were Angel Pod. There were no copies of Malira.
I think Kiki Pod is basically gone at this point.
Yeah, I haven't seen Kiki Pod. I think it's probably a reasonable deck choice if you are experienced with it. But the Angel Pod, the mana's good, and you just grind very hard. The Siege Rhinos and the Restoration Angels that people have basically put in for the Malira combo cards are just so good in the format right now. Like, Siege Rhino, I think a while ago we had probably talked about that for our modern set review, and that card is just very, very good. I died in one of my games against a junk player last week to him just peeling Siege Rhino off the top, and the game just ended because it actually just burned me out. The 3 Angel Pod decks were very, like, their actual all 75 were very, very close to each other. I think they were probably all within 5 or 6 cards total. There was one that had 3 Siege Rhinos, a couple that had 2, a couple that had 1 Restoration Angel, a couple that had 2, but by and large, it's the same stuff. And they all had, I believe, a lot of copies of Voice of Resurgence. I think they were all 3 copies, if I remember correctly. They've got
and
a
then
lot of voices. And it's
here's
just,
another thing that they have as well, is that the pod decks seem to be running at least 2, sometimes up to 4 Abrupt Decay main deck. And that's another card that can give a Delver deck fits. They are often very threat light, and they plan on getting down that early threat and being able to power through things. So, for example, I get my Monastery Swift Spear. I don't care that you have Kitchen Finks, because I grow my Swift Spear to a 3-4. The next turn I grow it to a 2-3. I'm going to chew through your stuff. Now, if you Abrupt Decay at mid-combat or something like that, then I'm going to be having to look for my Delver. I'm going to be trying to get Young Pyromancer together without you getting Orzhov Pontiff in response. So I think it's interesting that we had seen Pod nearly drop off the radar with Delver, and then it snapped right back as people said, I'm going to play more Voices. I'm going to play more Abrupt Decays. I'm not going to play as many paths main deck. I'm going to play what works. And it speaks to the resiliency of that deck. You know, they're also abandoning a combo that relies on a 2-2 and a 1-1 to be both in play. I think that's wise. And I suppose they get some benefit from Scavenging Ooze being able to suppress a Treasure Cruise, although I've rarely seen a Scavenging Ooze actually outrace Treasure Cruise or Dig Through Time.
Yeah, it's hard to fight that battle, just because if you were doing that, you're basically spending your whole turn to activate Scavenging Ooze. I think we talked a little bit about sort of the resurgence of Pod last week, as we've been talking about the GP Madrid results. And, you know, one of the reasons to play the Pod deck is that you can sort of adapt to many situations. You know, if you want to play the game that Blue Red Delver is playing with lots of X1s, you've got cards like Orzhov Pontiff, and Orzhov Pontiff is just terrible for the Delver decks to deal with. And then when their main removal spell is Lightning Bolt and Vapor Snag, you have cards like Siege Rhino that are immune to Lightning Bolt and more or less immune to Vapor Snag too. So I think the big thing was is that a lot of they just weren't playing cards, the Pod deck specifically, weren't playing cards that were really good against the Delver deck. And now they are again. Mm-hmm. So there's a big resurgence in that, you know, just casting Treasure Cruise is not the only way to gain card advantage. Sometimes casting very difficult to do with creatures and then birthing Pod is good enough, or much better in some cases than that. But yeah, it's been a very interesting mix of the Delver decks fighting the combo decks and the Pod decks fighting all those.
You know, I think we had spoken about this a few weeks ago about how if you are, like, for example, red-green aggro is pretty well, does pretty well against blue-red Delver for the reason that it just keeps peeling bigger guys every turn, mm-hmm. and eventually one of them sticks. It reminds me of an era in about 2004, 2005 in Vintage. There was a blue-red fish deck. It ran Nullrod, Spiketail Hatchling, Cloud of Fairies. It was a glorious time to be playing. And it murdered control decks. If you played Islands, Fish would beat you. It had like a 70 to 80% win rate. Still pretty good against workshop decks. There was a deck that a teammate of mine came up with that was blue-green fish that he called Worse Than Fish. And the idea was that you would shed the red cards and you would pick up green cards, notably Call of the Herd, to be beating the fish decks because fish at that time operated like Delver does today. You stick a threat or two and then you play a whole lot of annoying aggressive tempo cards and then you get there. And the idea was, I'm just going to keep running out 3/3s every single turn and you're not going to be able to beat it. And it was true. It was a miserable matchup. And I think that's sort of the thing we're seeing now with Pod, is that Pod players are saying, we're going to be playing the deck that doesn't try and combo, doesn't try and make the most of its birthing pod. It just runs out bigger dudes all the time. And God forbid I hit a Restoration Angel to blink a Kitchen Finks or reset a Siege Rhino.
I think the thing that I really like about the Pod decks now, and I say this, you know, everyone should know, I would never be caught dead playing a Pod deck, but by cutting the Malira and all of the cards associated with the Malira combo, with the exception of, like, Kitchen Finks, because that's just a good card. Red Cap for more or less the same reason. You get all the chaff out of your deck, basically. If you are running just the Angel Spike Feeder combo, you have one card in your deck that feels like chaff to me, basically, and that's the Spike Feeder. And it's not even that bad. Like, putting a counter from that guy onto Kitchen Finks to reset Persist seems fine. And the Archangel is just very good on its own. There's not a ton of things that profitably deal with it, because, again, it's immune to your Lightning Bolts and your Abrupt Decays. So, basically, they cut the fluff, and it seems like a much more streamlined version of Pod with all of the value cards that I thought they should always have been playing. Like, three or four voices always felt really good to me in that deck, because there really aren't too many matchups where that card is bad. Even when your opponent isn't ever really casting spells on your turn, or is playing a deck that doesn't want to, having a guy that is, like, more or less immune to removal is really good. Guys that leave guys behind or guys that come back are awesome, because, quite frankly, there's not that many cards that get played in this format that that really deal super well with the Voice of Resurgence on turn two. So,
and you know, you mentioned cutting the chaff. You draw a card that costs one white and three colorless. Do you want that card to be Ranger of Eos, or do you want it to be Restoration Angel?
Exactly.
Jeez, if you're playing four drops, do you want to be drawing Siege Rhino? Do you, you know, I mean, it's one thing to be like, well, my opponent is tapped out and doing nothing and has no cards in hand, and I can just do whatever I want. So theoretically, I'm going to pot a Kitchen Finks into Ranger of Eos and be able to combo off next turn by getting Viscera Seer and this and that. But, I mean, that doesn't happen as much as you draw the Ranger of Eos, you grumpily play it, you get two Noble Hierarchs, and then you say go.
When your Ranger of Eos was finding you two Deathrite Shamans,
that was awesome. Yeah, that was a lot better.
But now, the one drops, it's not that they're bad, just two Noble Hierarchs is far less impactful, or a Noble Hierarch and a Viscera Seer is far less impactful than two Deathrite Shamans. And when that four drop that you're getting is, you know, is a Restoration Angel or a Siege Rhino, it just seems so much better to me than wanting to go for that Ranger of Eos. About your Abrupt Decay comment before, they were all the pod decks were four pods, three Abrupt Decays in the main, and then all creatures. And it's
were they running cords?
No, none of them had cords.
Now that's interesting.
Let me check. I don't believe any of them had cord.
And that is a concession to the format being a lot faster now.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that not playing cord does is because I think a lot of people probably have your Shadow of Doubts and your Aven Mind Sensors now to deal with Scapeshift. Those also are very good against Pod in general. And you're more about playing value creatures, and if you don't have Pod, it's okay because you no longer have Malira in your deck to worry about. You're not playing Grizzly Bears anymore. So, yeah, it seems good. I never thought I'd say this, but I like where all these pod lists were.
So, Adam, you have a list of cards to talk about, whether they're good or not right now.
Yeah,
Birthing Pod would be one of those right now, but take us through the rest of the list.
So, came from looking at the top eight, seeing some of the stuff that people were doing here. So the first one was Courser of Kruphix, because that was in the Scapeshift top eight. I believe that was in some of the junk mid-range decks from the GP as well, as between one and three of, depending on whose list you're looking at, I think. I think it's a very playable card. I think it's good in that deck because it passes the Lightning Bolt test. And that was one of the criteria, basically, for that junk deck, because it cut all the Dark Confidants, basically, for Siege Rhino. So you're playing Tarmogoyf, Scavenging Ooze, Siege Rhino, Courser of Kruphix. Some combination of those is your creature base, so it makes Lightning Bolt pretty bad against you, which was the whole idea. So I think it's quite playable. I'm not sure I'm in love with it, but it is somewhat of a card advantage engine, and it's a little awkward for a lot of decks to have to deal with. It's got a big butt, so it blocks pretty well.
Corey, how do you feel about Courser of Kruphix?
Seems okay in the junk decks, but I in the Scapeshift deck, I would be willing to try it, but I think Electrolyze is probably just better in that deck. But I'm playing the more Izzet Charm, so I like keeping mana open. I can have Izzet Charm in turn, or Electrolyze and Cryptic. I like having more open mana, rather than just playing myself out.
It seems like it fills kind of the same role as Electrolyze in that deck, where it's your 3-drop that helps you against some of the aggressive decks. And
I will say that I had read that about Scapeshift, that is a deck that wants to cast a spell and play a land every turn, mm-hmm. so it wants to be drawing 2 cards. With Courser, you're going to hit more of your land drops.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next on the list, then?
I have Wall of Omens. It's always been a card I liked, because I like playing decks that sit behind walls and don't do anything. Mm-hmm. It seems like a little bit of a stretch for me right now to want to cast that card. It doesn't really interact profitably with any of the cards in Blue-Red Delver, and doesn't interact too well with the cards in Junk. But somebody had emailed us in and asked about Wall. I thought it was all right in some of the old Blue-White-Red twin decks, but recently LSV posted a video on Channel Fireball of a Blue-White-Red twin deck that he had been working on that didn't have any Kiki Jikis in it, and it was another one of those decks that is making itself ostensibly immune to Lightning Bolt. He had 4 Deceiver Exarchs and a Village Bellringer, which was awesome. So, not in love with it. It doesn't interact too well in the format, and it's not a big enough speed bump, I think, right now, to make it worth it.
Corey, are you going to be playing Wall of Omens?
No, that's enough for me.
Yeah, I think that in the format of incremental card advantage, I don't know that this is that format. I mean, certainly it only shuts down Monastery Swift Spear. I guess it's a little better against Burn, because you're trying to actively run them out of cards, and they have to spend 2, you know, a Swift Spear and a card and, and an attack step. You can absorb 4 or 5 damage out of that, but I'm still not in love with Wall of Omens.
Yeah, it's okay, but not.
Now, Wall of Shards and Wall of Denial and Plume Veil, I'm pretty big on right now, but
yeah,
we'll save that for a different day.
Yeah, not exactly what I want to be doing. So, Pyroclasm, another one I've got. In this conversation, we can also talk about all of the 2 and 3 mana, or even 1 mana, 2 mana, red sweepers. You've got your Electricaries, your Pyroclasms, your Volcanic Fallouts, your Anger of the Gods, and now to a much lesser extent than all of those, Fire Spout, which is pretty much superfluous when you've got Anger of the Gods, unless red is a incredible problem, for the deck you're playing. I don't hate Pyroclasm. Specifically, it appeared in some of the Scapeshift lists in both the main deck and the sideboard. It seems pretty reasonable in those decks. I actually think, overall, I like Anger of the Gods the most out of all of those now, because the threat from Birthing Pod is, once again, very big. Pod is, once again, very popular, still very powerful. Flexing its muscles, and Anger deals so much better with Pod than a Pyroclasm does that I think it's warranted. If you really need to crap on Blue-Red Delver, I think Volcanic Fallout is where you want to be against that deck, because it kills everything in their deck and there's not really anything they can do about it. But as you can see from the Star City Top 8 and from GP Madrid, I think Blue-Red Delver is like much less of a threat to win a tournament now than it was a month ago or 3 weeks ago. And I think that's showing by the number of other decks that are available. So just building your deck with the idea of beating Blue-Red Delver now, I think, is not the best strategy in the world.
So I went through the similar thought process with you. I am currently playing Blue-Red Twin, and I feel like you need to have a sweeper of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
I'm running 2 Pyroclasm on the board now, with the thinking that I'd rather Pyroclasm Affinity than wait a turn and Anger the Gods them.
Mm-hmm.
Things can just go haywire in that extra turn. I have played against Delver with it. I mean, unfortunately, it gets Spell Snared. But on the plus side, you have a chance. I don't know why this is. I feel better about burning a Pyroclasm to kill one creature than burning an Anger of the Gods. I feel like for the extra mana, I want to get the extra value, and that's just kind of greedy. On the other hand, it's not quite as good against Monastery Swift Spear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of out on it. I'm thinking like you are. I might be swapping for Anger of the Gods tonight when I play. But I can certainly see the justification for Pyroclasm. It's clean. You know what you're going to get. You're never going to lose the game staring at five lands and one mountain and holding it to Anger of the Gods in your hand. Whereas a Pyroclasm, you can just crack off whenever you want. Corey, you play Scapeshift. There are certainly a whole lot of different sweepers to play in that. How do you make your decisions about what to run week to week?
Well, currently we have the three Pyroclasms on the board. With the increase of Pod, maybe Anger is better, but with Affinity and Delver, Pyroclasm has just been the best, because it's still good against Pod. And I don't think you're as worried about exiling their creatures, like a Kitchen Fang's coming back, or an XX token isn't as bad. You're not really worried about those cards in the first place, you're just more worried about sweeping the board.
That matchup's, I think, a little bit different also, because Scapeshift is pretty good against
the Pod decks already. As well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I've got Snapcaster Mage on here also. I think probably 2 months ago, that's one that would have been an easy, yes, this card's insane. And I still think Snapcaster Mage is a really, really good card. But in a lot of the blue decks that I've been playing, where before I would have wanted Snapcaster Mage, all I want to do now is cast Dig Through Time instead. And, you know, you can certainly make the argument that sometimes Snapcaster Mage is better than the Dig Through Time, because it'll get you something, or it can be a lot cheaper. You don't have to worry about exiling cards from your yard or paying a lot of mana for it. But basically what I did with Blue-White Red was cut all four Snapcaster Mages for four Dig Through Times. I haven't really looked back since casting Dig. I feel like I cast a Dig Through Time and I can't lose, basically. it just kind of feels like that. Whereas you don't get the same kind of feeling with Snapcaster Mage. That being said, it was in almost all the blue decks in the top 16 of Richmond, being played alongside Dig Through Time in a lot of cases, although they were not running four Dig Through Times and four Snapcasters. You had a mix of both, so maybe the right answer falls somewhere in between where you want a mix. But I think it's a good card that is not just the best thing that you can play anymore. You have real decisions with Dig Through Time, Treasure Cruise, and Snapcaster Mage.
And I think you're right that Snapcaster is still a very good card. I think the question is now how many. It was a given four of in many twin decks. People are trimming down three and even two. It was even a one of or a none of in many blue-red Delver decks because they just have better things to do with their mana and their time than to be Snapcasting out of the graveyard. Mm-hmm. You know, barring Snapcasting a Treasure Cruise, which is obviously awesome. Every time I look at cutting Snapcaster Mages, especially from Twin, I know people are probably getting tired of hearing about it, but you have a whole bunch of little things that are awesome to Snapcast. Like, Snapcasting your one-ofs is great. Hitting that Flame Slash a second time, electrolyzing another time, knowing that you can play essentially five dispels if you have four Snapcaster Mages in your deck feels really, really cool. But that's been my experience. I am thinking about trimming down to three or even two in to try out other cards. I know that we talked about things like Vettelkin Shackles or swapping in another Izzet Charm or an Electrolyze or something like that. Corey, how many Snapcasters are you running in Scapeshift right now?
We are playing two, and I've been happy with the two. It's not so many that it's hurting the Dig Through Times, but it is really nice to have them to, on like turn, well, not turn five, but on turn four, let's say you have extra mana and you want to snap the journey to get another land.
Yeah.
So that search you can like, or search, yeah. Search, so you can get another land and then you can just combo them on the next turn. Also, sometimes if they don't hurt themselves with their lands, you have to push through a little bit of damage. You can't always do it with the Tribe Elder. You have to play Snapcaster to hit them. And with the Dig Through Time, getting Snapcaster in like a bolt or something to restabilize yourself on the board is really nice. Like I went against Affinity, I was pretty much dead on board and I digged on his turn and got Snapcaster Bolt and I bolted his guy and then snap bolted and blocked and it was just like so much fun.
Yeah. Bolt snap bolt is still a heck of a board stabilizer as well. So yeah.
And with the four Izzet Charms, the two Snapcasters have been good also. Yeah. You can see a lot of cards.
I think I agree with what both of you guys said, where it's not an automatic, you know, four of in a lot of decks anymore, because now you have some more meaningful decisions about what you're doing with your graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
But still very powerful, still very playable. We'll stay blue. I've got a Remand up here. I think we talk about this card a lot. I know that Doug likes it a lot. And I think Remand is really good in certain decks. I think it's reasonable in Blue-Red Delver. I think it is pretty good in both Twin and Scapeshift. But beyond those decks, I don't think I really want to be casting Remand. Like, Remand is out of my Blue-White-Red list. It's been out for a while now. In that deck, I just don't want to cast it against anything. There are no decks where I actually want that in my deck. Basically, I cut the Remands for Shadow of Doubts.
You know, and Remand is a card that I don't know if I play it wrong versus other people, because people say they always side out Remand versus Pod decks, and I'm thinking, like, why on earth do you do that? That is just the best deck to Remand for a turn, because they have no other sources of card advantage, and Remanding a Kitchen Sphinx feels the most awesome. I like it because I like to play decks that have or foreseeable goal that they are building toward. Mm-hmm. Scapeshift is definitely one of those. I am cut down to three Remands because they really do suck after turn four or five. And I'm just tired of playing a card that is not live on turn one. It's awesome turns two through four, and then you just hope to cycle it later on and annoy an opponent. But, Corey, are you running any... You're running some Remands in Scapeshift, four. Right?
Yeah. It's pretty good in Scapeshift. Because you want to... I would never play in a control deck, really, because a lot of the control decks, you just want to have more answers than they have threats. And Remand doesn't do that. But in any combo decks or tempo decks where you're trying to delay them while you get ahead on board, or just whether playing lands to combo or having creatures hitting them, that's when Remand's best.
You know, I recall a game that I had played. I was playing against somebody playing the Through the Breach and Goryeo's Vengeance deck with Grizzlebrand, and I remember I had lost game one, won game two, and then I was on the play game three, so win, lose, win, I suppose. But I had opened a hand, I'd mulled the six, and I was on the play, and my hand was land, and four Remands. And if you talk about what's a dream hand for a deck, I thought, I will never, ever lose with this. Unless they go off turn one, which we have to respect that Goryeo's Vengeance deck can sometimes do that. I thought, I'm never going to lose. And I didn't. I absolutely didn't, because if I get to cast Time Walk for four turns, and you get to develop...
Time Walk, draw a card.
Yeah, Time Walk, draw a card. Get to develop nothing for four turns. That's... I just feel like, yeah, my ideal hand is not like land, twin, Exarch. My ideal hand is seeing four Remands and two lands, and then it doesn't even matter if there's a seventh card. And that's how powerful that card is when you're on the play.
Yeah, so... We like Remand.
I think I would not be playing Remand in Delver,
level,
though.
Yeah, very.
Corey, you would like that hand in Scapeshift, too, right?
I was playing red, white, blue, like, tempo against Defendi. I was on the play, and I had three Remands. And he had a weird hand where I think he played, like, a one drop, like a Springleaf Drum, and passed. And then the next turn he played Vault Scourge, paying two life, and I remanded it. And then he played it again next turn, and I remanded it because he never hit land drops.
Oh,
so
my.
I had to remand three times.
I mean, I tend to board. I board them out on the draw most of the time, and also I tend to board them out against Affinity. But you can still hit, if somebody's playing the four edge champion build, you can still nail that. You can nail in Soul Artifact. There's a lot of things in those decks that you can still cause problems.
Yeah, the value of Remand certainly goes up exponentially when you are on the play, mm-hmm. versus on the draw.
So I think if you're going to be running Remand, you have to have cards that are good on the draw that you're bringing in, which means you're not bringing in Electrolyze, you're bringing in Fork Bolt, because you need something specifically in there to...
Yeah, you need something quick.
Yep.
Yeah, so, yep.
Remand's also pretty good against the Delve, because if people are playing Tragic Cruise or Dig Through Time and they're exiling all their cards, then you bring it back. I was playing Scapeshift against the Delver, and I took out Remands, but he took out Treasure Cruise because he was afraid that I was going to remand from his Delve, which I don't know if that was right from him.
I think that's a poor play.
That's a lot of levels deep.
So he was like, oh, I took those out. I was like, well, I took out my Remands. He's like, oh, well.
It's certainly really good in that sense against the Blue Red Delver decks when, for remanding the Delve spells, when those decks don't play very many lands and they're depending on delving a lot, not like Blue-White-Red deck that's going to have, you know, six or eight lands in play when you win the game, so that just casting some of those without really delving at all is a possibility. But when it's not possible, yeah, the value of remanding those spells goes through the roof. So I've got two more cards on the list.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do Abrupt Decay.
I like it.
It's been, I think, a staple in a lot of formats, probably all the formats, basically, when it got spoiled from Return to Ravnica. It is black-green, uncounterable, and it's an instant and destroys a non-land permanent that costs three or less. It's got targets in virtually all the decks in the format. It might just be as simple as floating to and blowing up a Blood Moon so you can continue to cast your spells. It can be used as removal to get guys out of the way or deal with other specific problem permanents like in Birthing Pod. And it's good as both a proactive and a defensive card. So it's not particularly good against most decks that I would ever play, but I think it's a pretty quality card overall in the format, and I think decks that have access to play it should certainly look at least playing a couple copies of it.
Abrupt Decay also affects a deck like Twin at a very crucial time.
Mm-hmm.
It can affect the Delver deck where somebody spent three or four spells to get their Swift Spear up real big. I totally understand and encourage the shift away from Path to Exile toward Abrupt Decay and the decks that can make that shift. Certainly it's a dog against Scapeshift, but that's one of the reasons Scapeshift is good, because your opponent starts with 12 dead cards in their deck.
Yeah, same thing with Blue White Red, where that card doesn't do a lot, but usually you have other cards in your deck that hopefully, might interact. I like it against a deck like Twin, especially if that deck becomes, or continues, you know, to stay where it is, not become it is. Because regular counter spells like Dispel or Remand, like that kind of stuff, does not affect Abrupt Decay in the slightest. So if you're trying to play around instant speed removal, your regular counter spells will not do it. You need something that makes your guys untargetable, like Mizzium Skin or something like that. And it makes it harder for your opponent to have you have to have more answers, so it makes your opponent, it makes it harder for your opponent to have the right answer if they've got to have more diverse ones, basically. So you're playing several and hoping that you have the right one for the right spell, but if you don't, you're out of luck, basically.
So what's our last one on our list here?
Our last one, I think, is a little spicy. It's Tarmogoyf. I think it's probably the best vanilla creature to have ever been printed.
So let's look at what's been oppressing Tarmogoyf right now. The fact that decks are playing Delve cards to remove the early pumps to Tarmogoyf, so it can miraculously shrink mid-combat due to a dig through time. Also, Young Pyromancer spawns a virtual army that can block Tarmogoyf every single turn while swinging around it. But in spite of those two factors, Corey, how do you feel about Tarmogoyf right now?
I don't think he's very good right now. He's usually not big enough to beat the mid-range decks. Like a Siege Rhino normally is bigger than him, or tied. And yeah, like with all the Delve, he's just not very good.
He doesn't get you value when he comes into play, and although that might be okay because he only costs two mana, Spell Snares are in every single blue deck right now, because I think that card is very good in Modern, especially when people are casting Tarmogoyfs. And excuse me. I agree, he's usually not big enough to run over a Siege Rhino, especially with the Delve cards. I think there's really only one deck where you want to be, several decks, same archetype, where you want to be casting him. I think that's the black-green rock decks. I think that's pretty much the only place where I really want him. And the reason for that is that those decks tend to play, like, six or eight targeted hand disruption spells and four Lilianas, so that even after graveyards get emptied, they fill back up.
Now, I'm going to call you to task here, though. Grand Prix Madrid was won by a Rug Delver deck that ran Tarmogoyfs instead of Swift Spears, so there has to be something to the card.
I don't think it can be actively bad, because he's still very good, but because he's a a threat that can win the game for two mana, basically. But I think, overall, Young Pyromancer just feels like a better two drop to me, right now. And we go back, you know, to the card we just talked about, Abrupt Decay. Abrupt Decay kills your Tarmogoyf, and your Tarmogoyf doesn't leave anything behind, whereas Abrupt Decay kills your Pyromancer and it leaves a couple tokens behind. It's also pretty impossible for a Tarmogoyf to actually race a Young Pyromancer, making an army of guys. So,
you know, another factor, I mean, I keep talking about Swift Spirit is just that good. If you have a Tarmogoyf out and it's a 5/6, and I have a Monastery Swift Spirit and I cast Ataxian Probe and attack you with a 2/3, what are you gonna do? You know, because if you block, I cast Lightning Bolt on it, my Monastery Swift Spirit comes a 3/4, and then they trade. And I've, or I Vapor Snag your Tarmogoyf in the beginning of combat and get at you for 3 anyway.
Yeah, it's, I don't think it can be bad, because it still is a very good card.
You know, the times when you don't have what it takes to stop Tarmogoyf are the times when it really punishes you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in one of the rounds I had last week against the junk opponent, he cast basically a Tarmogoyf where he had nothing in his graveyard, and basically on my end step, cast Dig Through Time, got rid of all the cards in my graveyard, and then on my turn electrolyzed his Tarmogoyf, and it's just tough. Like, if that had been a different card, like a Young Pyromancer, or even a Swift Spear, like, it makes killing it a lot, or it makes killing it and not getting, or getting some value off of it a lot different, so.
So yeah, with Tarmogoyf, though it's not bad, it's not able to go to its maximum potential because it is best in the discard decks, and those decks aren't good right now because with Treasure Cruise and Dig Through Time, you can't play.
Yeah. One for one discard when your opponent is playing draw two and draw threes, is a little bit of a stretch for me. When your value is one for one-ing and then playing guys that are bigger when your opponent is just drawing a lot more cards than you, it's a little tough. So, yeah, I don't think it's bad, but I think you can be doing better things than, casting a Tarmogoyf right now, so.
You know, and I just will wrap up here talking about little in-game strategies and things you've learned lately, if you have little tips and tricks to share. Mine is that I've been testing a lot of Twin versus Delver, and I have found that the best use of a Pestermite or Deceiver Exarch is during their upkeep and out their draw step, tapping down their their Delver of Secrets or their Swift Spear. And I have been leaving in my two Pestermites post-board, which I used to cut thinking that they'll just burn them out. And if you actually just spend 3 mana to tap out their dude and make them blow a burn spell, it's very, very hard to lose against a Delver deck when you do that because you buy so many turns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those play adjustments I've been playing for years, that a Deceiver Exarch, you know, it's going to get bolted and killed every time you block with it. But if you use it to tap down their guys during their upkeep, you buy so much more time. And it's much better, by the way, to do that during their upkeep proactively than to wait until they attack and hope they get greedy. I mean, if they peel the Swift Spear and they can pump it up and attack, good for them. But I'd rather get somebody during their own upkeep that way.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely agree.
So I will task you guys to think up little in-game tips and tricks to think about for next week. And until then, I'd like to thank people for listening. This week we talked about a list of cards on Is It Good, our recurring perennial enjoyable segment. If you have cards that you would like to add to it, let us know. We talked about the Star City Open, as well as noting the what is important by what is absent, namely one Treasure Cruise deck, no Jeskai Ascendancy. You know, if you go back and you look at what people were talking about 6-8 weeks ago, you might see a huge difference in this metagame. People would say you're crazy if you think that that's what you predict the results would be, but in fact, that's what they are consistently. So we talked about that. We are going to sign off for this week. Happy holidays to the people who have holidays coming up this week and coming up in the next few weeks. Until then, I'm Doug Lynn.
I'm Adam.
I'm Corey.
And you've been listening to The Modern Enthusiast.